administer it, they're properly trained to testify about it. And then the other thing is, I think we need to work on our tox books, that there is, for example, you know, if you have X nanograms of active THC in your blood, that is a different kind of an impairment that's occurring, and they won't come out and testify. So we have to kind of tease that testimony out of them.
Yeah.
And I think that's something we should really approach to them, to say, look, we need you to really recognize that this issue is going on, and you've got to start thinking about how to apply about this as well.
Well, and I appreciate that, Sim. We have a state DRE conference in June that I'm presenting at, and I'll be talking about some of the court considerations that DREs need to be prepared at. I'll be modifying that same presentation and giving it at OOMPA to the prosecutors at the trial. This is something I'm working with Jason Marshall, the state DRE coordinator with UHP. We're really trying to encourage more agencies to send officers to DRE school. The problem is we get kickback from chiefs and sheriffs because it's 2 weeks, somebody off the road, it's expensive. Well, not for them, because the state covers
and
then they don't use them.
And they don't use them. And then the other thing is, because we have a metabolite, if you can establish the metabolite, why go through the hassle of actually showing impairment?
Exactly.
You know?
So we do get pushback on that, but we're trying to advertise that.
Two things with regard to the statistics, you know, with regard to the active THC in the blood, for most people it's only a 4-hour window. So where in that 4-hour window did that accident happen, and where in that 4-hour window is the blood drawn? If you're outside the 4 hours, you're not going to know. The other way that we're behind the wheel, both in law enforcement and prosecution, is with the vaping, because they now have those liquids that have the THC in them, that have the hash oil, that have all the other stuff in them, and we do not have a way to detect that when it's in their possession.
Would a blood draw not do that on the vape?
But I mean,
you talk about the vape materials themselves.
The vape materials themselves. Yeah. So I mean, you know, because the officer can smell the marijuana, but if it got the THC liquid and they're vaping it.
Yeah. All those look like an e-cigarette.
It's all that that cloud that comes out of the car. Who knows what it is? Unless the dog starts whining, then you know maybe what it is.
You know, in drilling down to statistics, sorry, Sam, if there's any way to know, because there's a claim of a large opioid epidemic in Utah for prescription drugs, is there any way to, on those fatalities, just to try to figure out where to orient ourselves to training more expertise, but is there a way to differentiate those with those that have maybe abused prescription drugs or were using prescribed, whether unlawfully using it or unlawfully prescribed, as opposed to the street drug, to kind of try to figure out where the problem is and orient ourselves towards that?
I can ask that.
The problem is also in the legitimate use of them.
That's what I mean, yeah. Like it may be prescribed and you just are using it, obviously that would be a defense.
But remember, under our impairment standard, you can have a prescribed legitimate use. I have to just show impairment. If the prescription doesn't change the fact, alcohol is a legal drug.
Yeah.
You know, it's the impairment of it that you look at. So
opioid, heroin.
That's exactly
what they're doing. All drugs are legal.
Yeah. Under the prescription law. Yeah.
The problem with prescription drugs on that, though, is that they have the accident, they're involved in the accident, go to the hospital, and you never have a chance to look at their actual impairment without seeing, you know, what was the precipitating factor of the accident. We're usually not there when it happens.
Yeah.
So when you have those legal drugs, it's almost impossible when there's actually an accident that they go to the hospital in to prove a DUI after that.
I mean, if we're going to drill down to see
the hospital's going to do blood.
This is all highway safety statistics.
And that initial draw
things that don't necessarily control.
Then
so
you also
can
have a record
as
well,
just
given to that to see what the threshold is. So you can have a comparison. But it requires a lot of effort.
But it sounds like there's a topic, so maybe what I'll do is I'll work with my grant people to see if sometime in 2018 we can bring a prosecuting the drug driver course to Utah. If you have certain people, I would suggest that it's going to be by invitation. It wouldn't be something that we just post and say, who wants to go, unless we're having a hard time filling it up. But specifically invite people to come and do it, spread it out across the state. Ryan, Jen?
Well, Sim asked if we see them. The only other feedback I give is maybe I just think we're good and everybody else is bad. That's how we always view the world, right? But I tend to think we do a fair to very good job on prosecuting them when we get them. To me, the biggest thing is that, and if I were figuring out how to spend money on training, it would be the PD. Because I think,
yeah.
I think police officers don't feel comfortable doing these because they don't know how to do them. And they're,
that's right.
When you get a drunk driver, you smell the odor of alcohol, he's weaving, and you kind of buy it, and you know you're stuck with it, and they don't like doing them either, but they do do them. You get that same case with the odor of pot, and they got a pipe in the car. That's a simple one. They go, drug paraphernalia citation, impound the car. I ain't doing it. I didn't.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're impaired. I don't want to know if you're impaired.
Right.
And I think that it's a lack of comfort amongst the PDs in our cities and counties. And I think they're, I mean, literally every day I screen a case that I know was a DUI,
yeah.
but it didn't get looked at that way. And I think that's where I'd put the money and the training resources if it was me.
Well, and that's more of a, that would be more of a post.
Your in-department training,
but,
too.
And it's funny because I totally get what you say, but as I go out and deal with officers, their perspective is, why am I going to do a DUI investigation when I know that chicken prosecutor is just going to dismiss it anyways and not going to take the hard case? And so there's a lot of finger-pointing, and I think we can all do better. That's really the answer, is all of us can, in this area, especially since it's new or newer and there's new trends out there.
But Ryan's right, that the detection of that starts in the field.
Absolutely.
Okay? A prosecutor is only going to be able to do what they get handed as that sort of screened material, how that case comes to you. And I agree with you, Ryan. I think the deficit is that the reason we're not good at it as prosecutors because we don't see enough cases because they're not being generated in the field, in the volume that's out there, the need that's out there.
In West Valley, about 5 or 10 years, we've gone from about 500 DUI arrests a year to about 200 over a 10-year period a year. So
yeah.
Less than, and our DUI accidents have gone from about 100 to about 250.
Yeah.
So it's all just enforcement.
Yeah.
All right. Tyson, any more on your report?
Yeah.
Nope.
All right. You got
it. That's an interesting
subject. No, you skipped.
Yeah.
Open this here.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Replacing Donna's position, the domestic violence sexual assault resource prosecutor. House Bill 200, which we'll hear about tomorrow, but I don't know that really you guys are going to spend much time on the DPC, DPS training aspect.
We are not.
Yeah. So, good, because I'm gonna talk about it the following day during my presentation.
Okay.
Okay, perfect. But anyway, to let you know, so the bottom part of HB 200, Representative Romero wrote in that UPC and DPS shall create a training program for trauma-informed response for sexual assault and sexual abuse cases. The statute says that all officers in the state will be trained in this, the basic training, by July of 2018. It then specifies that detectives must receive some advanced training by the following year. I appreciate Representative Romero. She really fought for the funding, as it says there in the note, or in my notes, we're gonna have a dedicated amount of $186,000. Where that amount came from is Ned Searle asked me for those numbers before Donna left us, and so I based it on the salary that the council approved. Remember, you know, you approved a 5% or an equivalent to a grade 5 attorney increase, and so I based it on that. He also said to include travel costs for her to go to, there's a couple of national conferences that she would attend each year that deal with trauma, travel in-state, cell phone costs, and some of these other admin things. And so I included all of that. Representative Romero fought for that amount. It initially was cut. Ned said to do a wish list. So I actually threw in a half-time employee to cover all of the admin, you know, scheduling, but that got cut. But everything else stayed the same. In fact, her attitude was, she actually agreed to cut funding for I'm not sure how many lab technicians the tox lab is getting, but she said I'm willing to cut that because she felt the legislature would be more willing to approve funding for that next year as opposed to, you know, coming back and saying we need money for prosecutors. So she really went to bat for us on this. So what that means is that we're going to be able to hire somebody with a lot of experience. It's an interesting side note. I didn't think about it until just now. Maybe I, you know, could have put it in here, but those of you all know Detective Boardman, West Valley City. Ryan, close your ears.
I'm discreet.
No. Detective Boardman just approached me and said, does it have to be a prosecutor for this position? And I'll just leave it at that. Marilyn and I have talked about it a little bit, but that poses an interesting question. Is the statute doesn't say it has to be a prosecutor? I agree. I think it needs to be, especially because even though the language here is only dealing with trauma, she does intend that it also be a domestic violence, or handle domestic violence issues as well. So even though he asked me that, which means I don't know if he's wanting to leave West Valley City, but he made that request. Now the issue is, a couple issues, is the funding won't come in, still start till July 1st, but right now we're in temporary offices that I'll talk about in just a minute down at College Drive, so I don't have a place. Even if I had the money right now, I wouldn't have a place for that person. So what I anticipate is once we know when and where we will be moving to is like maybe 30 days prior to that move date, we'll put out a notice and then put together an interview panel. And Sim, if it's okay, I'd like Donna to be on that interview panel. Okay. So that's why we don't have a DVSRP currently. Any questions on that? Okay. PIMS, anything you want to say about PIMS, Ron?
It's decreasing in the usership because it's getting old and people are going to other things, and that's the way it probably should be. But so there's not a whole lot going on there. But if anybody has issues still, I'm still supporting it, glad to help whatever I can do. So if anybody that's still using it needs some help, just let me know and we'll.
Will there be an update? Maybe that was awesome.
There's no updates to it.
So, I don't mean like technology. Like, is there going to be a legal update for the new legal
changes?
Oh yes,
that's actually going to send out an email this week. It'll be ready to go before right now. I just have to get. I haven't uploaded it yet. But it'll be ready to go, so you can do the offense update.
That's all.
4 p.m. It'll be ready by tomorrow or the next day.
Okay, case management. Finally, I can report that we have made progress on our RFP. I thought that I had deleted the names. I only meant to, so I'm not going to say them. Of course, they'll become public when we publish this, but it won't be until after the RFP is done. So please don't talk to these individuals until the process is over, but now you know who they are. So the evaluation committee is composed of 2 county attorneys, 2 city prosecutors, 2 admin staff, and an IT person. We have had, last week, the committee met and reviewed the evaluations, and they scored them. And the way the scoring system, as it was designed, each vendor needed to receive 700 points out of 1,000, so 70%, to move on and be considered for live demonstration. We had 2 live demonstrations yesterday. The third, because of an email glitch, they did not find out. And so they're going to be presenting next Tuesday morning. So after that third presentation, then the committee will go in and they will review costs. Up to this point, we don't know anything about cost of the proposed, or of the vendors. And that's the way state purchasing has drafted the statute, as we review the written proposal, we observe live demonstration, and then go to cost. So I'm hoping that after next Tuesday, we will know who we're going with. And of course, the concern always is that the best company, or the one that everybody likes the most, is going to be too expensive. And so I've talked to Chris Jennings. He's our contract analyst advisor from State Purchasing. And he says we will cross that bridge when we get to it. So that's the update on the RFP. Any questions?
Have you heard anything from your executive staff on this at all?
On the UPC?
RFP, yeah.
I haven't. I mean, that's Dave Sarek. Are you expecting some response? I'm not in the loop on that, so
yeah.
I
don't
know.
Okay.
Do you see how many bids we've got?
I can't say that at
that's
this point.
Secret.
Well, yeah, it's just confidential.
Is the same thing?
What I will say is we didn't receive as many as I thought that we might, so I was a little surprised. But Yeah. Okay. Okay, so sorry, I can't tell you anymore, but that's on the RFP. Okay. So another questions. Okay, people on the state advisory boards, on the ones that I've handed you, the reason that is highlighted in yellow is I got that from Craig after I sent out the agenda last week, so that's why it's highlighted in yellow, is it's just added into that. Okay, then I guess it takes us to other business. Okay, so as I said, we have temporarily moved to College Drive. Hopefully you've all seen the emails that I sent out, but there's all the contact information there with our new phone numbers. Regardless of where we move within the building, I've been told that our phone numbers will remain the same. The new email address, the new email address is not because we have moved locations, it's because the state and the AG office has already started doing this, is converting to Office 365. So we're no longer using Google Mail, Gmail, and so that is the new email address. Somebody asked me why moving to College Drive we'd get a new email, but that has nothing to do with the move. The plan is, at least what we've been told, and we'll, like I said, we'll see what happens, is that we'll be moving up to the third floor. Currently we're occupying some extra offices down on the second floor. We have to wait for the state fire marshal to move out before we can make the move upstairs, and what we're being told is hopefully July, August sometime. So we're doing the best we can. If you want to come see my office, we've got boxes stacked to the ceiling. It's quite fun. So, all right, election of the UPC Region 1 council member. So Jan's term is up on June 14th. In the past, this always, or at least, I can't remember if it was Barry's term that expired and we didn't realize until after, so I'm trying to catch us beforehand. So Jan's term is up in June, and so Thursday night, yeah, at UCDAA's meeting, we'll have an election, and if Jan is back with us, that's great, but they will vote on that at that meeting. The Open Meetings Act review. I know we all kind of know what this is, but in light of recent events, I just felt that I needed to go over this. I will have a copy of the statute always with me at council meetings in case it ever comes up. But let me just run through this real quickly. Is we have to post a notice in our building or UPC meets that we're having a meeting. I have to post at the Utah Public Notice website. I didn't know this until 2 weeks ago, and I did get it posted for this week, but I have to post the agenda. Now, and then I have to provide notice to at least one newspaper of general circulation. Okay, the minutes. The statute says that I have to put something on the minutes to make it very clear that the pending minutes have not yet been approved. And so when you took a look at the minutes that I sent out, we're just gonna start including a header on the top of every page and the language right there. These pending minutes have not been approved by the Utah Prosecution Council and are subject to change until approved and adopted by the council. And then once they are adopted, then of course we'll remove that and indicate that they're final minutes. The location is open to the public. And so, if we continue to have these meetings here, Sam, I don't know what your policy is about letting the public in. The other option that we were talking as we walked over is we could hold this meeting either on the first floor of the Heber Wells building, their conference room is big enough, or down at College Drive. They have a large training room, which is about this size. We just, like you do here, we just have to rearrange the tables. But, it does have to be open.
As we go into our new building, we'll have sufficient space. Our training room and our large conference room is all going to be on the first floor. But our building is going to be a secure building.
Right.
If we want to do it, it's just that everybody goes through the same security process, and it's open to the public. So at that point, we don't have a problem as long as everybody follows the same security protocols mm-hmm. when we go into our new building.
So I guess the question, yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No.
So if we continue to have our meetings here, until your building is done, if we continue that model, if somebody showed up wanting, a member of the public wanting to come up here, are they allowed to do that?
Well, they can. I don't have a problem with that as long as we have some notice of who's coming up. I mean, as long as we you let me know and we can.
Well, I mean, see, that's just it. Is I mean, they could just show up at the. So would we want to move to a more, you know, that's easily accessible by the public?
No problem.
I'm just asking the council what your recommendations are.
I don't think any of the ladies down at the desk down there have ever asked me for an ID. They just, I say I'm here for the meeting, and they bring me up.
Yeah, they just let me know when people show up.
I mean, we can, I mean, the thing is, the bridge for us is for the remainder of this year.
Probably.
So we're thinking, what, two more meetings?
Yeah.
Right.
Just gotta know there's a meeting.
And they just gotta get it.
Our June meeting is gonna be.
On location.
On location.
Yeah, and.
And our fall is with fall conference.
And fall.
Somewhere by the conference.
Right.
Yeah, so.
So it's not even an issue.
Yeah.
Well, right, I didn't even think about, you know, with your new building. I was just, and I didn't realize it was gonna be done that soon, so.
Yeah.
We're scheduled, right now, our tentative occupancy is going to occur in the first quarter of next year.
Okay. All right, but it's like I said, it just has to be open to the public, and I don't know that we've really made that. One, I don't know, think that we've adequately made the public aware that we're having these meetings, and two, what, you know, your policy would be if someone showed up.
In our building, when you walk into the first floor, we're gonna have two PSO officers there.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll have a problem, sort of, like a security, sort of,
Right.
Magnetometers
that you have to go through.
I mean, and frankly, just from a security standpoint, I like that, you know, as opposed to like when we're down in St. George, anybody can just walk into a hotel.
Yeah.
So.
So the thing is, I think Paul's point is well taken, which is our meetings are pretty much well done.
Yeah.
If there is a meeting, we can do it. We can probably still accommodate as long as we're here. But by the time we roll around to that, I think we should be in our building.
Okay. Thank you. Moving on, closed meetings. We can only do that if a quorum is present. That's never really been an issue, but then 2/3 have to vote. And then when we go into closed meeting, the following shall be publicly announced and entered into the minutes. The reason that we're holding the closed meeting, the location where the meeting is, and then a vote by name for or against going into the motion for a closed meeting. The purpose of a closed meeting may only be for discussion of the character, professional competence, or physical or mental health of an individual, or for or pending reasonably imminent litigation. Then, during the closed meeting, we shall make a recording of the closed portion of the meeting, and we shall do that, but we may keep detailed written minutes. I know we keep detailed written minutes anyway. And then the recording has to be complete, unedited. Then, you know, and then these other things. So the reason that I bring that up is there, you know, an issue has been raised and addressed, and you're all aware that there was a closed meeting where a recording was not made. Let me finish this, then I'll come back. So the written and audio recording shall include the date, time, names, member present. They are protected records, but there is an exception where when the purpose is to discuss the character, professional, et cetera, we do not...
Or employment.
Exactly. We do not have to make a recording of that.
That's right.
Okay, so we went into a closed-door session recently in June of last year where the motion was to go into a closed-door meeting for pending litigation. Just to let you know, the sequence of events is we took a break to allow those that didn't need to be there to leave. We took, you know, council members took care of things. And as we were coming in, the nature of the conversation focused on, even before we sat down, was on the character, competence, et cetera, of an individual. So the recording was never, ever turned on. And I realized that's in violation of the statute. So what should have happened is we should have opened the meeting.
Then closed it
and stated why we were closing it. Now, it also includes that we have to include a statement from the presiding officer, an affidavit, as to why the meeting was closed and not recorded. And the chair, Chair Garside, provided an affidavit for that. But, you know, I realized that we were getting kind of sloppy in how we were doing things. I'll take the hit for that, for not looking closely enough at the statute, but we won't be making those mistakes in the future. Okay, next on my other business is Talking about civility, and I've got to apologize to Russell. We kind of, he was Sean's designee last time. We blindsided him with an animated discussion, to say the least, animated. So I apologize to him for that. You know, it was heated. You know, we all understand civility. And afterwards, I talked with Marilyn about it, and what she said that Mark's policy was, is if there's a council member there to which an issue was being directed, and they were a designee, yeah, if a designee was there for a council member, and the discussion was being directed towards that designee, that agency, Mark would ask, are you prepared to discuss that? And if the answer is no, then we would table the discussion. And so that's the policy that I'm going to proceed up. Well, maybe that's the chair, but I think that's the policy that we would like to do, so that we give everybody, you know, that we're not blindsiding a designee in the future. So again, like I said, I apologize to Russell that he was here for that. So, you know, trying to put council members on notice that we're that topic's going to come up, I'm not quite sure how to do that, other than, you know, especially if it evolves as part of a discussion. But, you know, when I send out the proposed agenda and the summary, I try to let people know ahead of time what we're going to be talking about. So, anyway, that's how we're going to proceed in the future. The next one is donation to the Utah Journal of Criminal Law. So I'm bringing this back from one of our previous meetings. There was some questions that were asked that I now know the answer to. One of them was, well, I stated to the council that the intent of the journal is to send copies out to every prosecutor, public defender, and judge in the state, and several of you had never received copies of the journal. What I found out is that, yes, that is the stated intent, but nobody really ever looked at the mailing list. I don't know where they would have gotten the mailing list. So I think that's one reason why all the prosecutors did not receive a copy of the journal. I'm on the editorial board, so I have taken the responsibility on to make sure that at least the prosecutor side of the mailing list is current and updated. The question was asked, subscription fee. I think, Jan, you had mentioned that you thought that you had paid a fee at one point, or fee for something. They said that was not for the journal. You know, they never charged a fee for that. And then online version is available, but it just receives very little traffic, and my guess is because nobody knows where it's at, where they can go and get it. I told the journal that we would make it as a link on our webpage so that prosecutors could see it, but the consensus of the editorial board is that they would really like to print hard copies to send out, so, you know, so other law review article or journals. So those were the questions that were asked. What the board is doing is they're sending out letters. Asked me to draft a letter, which I did. So yes, it's kind of put me in conflict. Maybe, I don't know, maybe not. Here I am, the prosecutor asking public defender, the big criminal defense attorneys for money. But I drafted the letter for the board to send out, asking for their donation in return. You know, they'll get a blurb or their business logo in the journal. So that's how the journal is trying to raise some additional money. So I told them that I would convey all of that to you as a council, and then just come back and ask if that answers your questions, if you're ready to discuss whether or not you want to make a donation. I thought I put in here, it's around $5,000 to publish and distribute the journal. Their goal is to do that twice a year. So does anybody have any other questions on the issue of the Utah Journal of Criminal Law?
How much money are they asking for?
Whatever we would be willing to donate. I suggested, you know, that we might be able to do 1,000 per issue.
And do they just want to do a paper because they think that people will be more responsive to that?
Mm-hmm. I can tell you, just based on the comments that I get with our newsletter, because I don't send out a paper newsletter, it's online. I get lots of people saying, please start up the paper one again. We just don't read it when it's online.
And I think one thing that was being done as we transitioned was that they would be emailed out, and then offices would.
Right, right, and that's.
But you still had to send it out as opposed to them coming to you to get it.
Right, right. I mean, the other thing is obviously if we make a donation, then our logo is going to appear in the journal as well.
They don't think email will be sufficient. They just want to have something that can hold in their hands, mm-hmm. because they're not used to electronic devices.
Notice how the young guy hasn't at least had there at old school.
Is, you